First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
Florida's new Surgeon General says kids with COVID don't have to quarantine. The city's main library is shut down indefinitely to give out Regeneron treatments. And what in the world is going on with trash pickup in this town? Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. Get on the line now at 549-2937. You can listen on the radio or watch our live stream on Facebook, YouTube, and on demand at PBS Jack's Passport. So the news is coming up, but then later in the hour, stick around as we speak with author Bill Delaney on his new book, Secret Jacksonville. That's ahead. But first, it's Friday, and here to discuss a busy news week, we welcome regular contributor Charles Griggs. Hi, Charles. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Freelance writer, journalist Claire Goforth with us. Hey, Claire.
Hey, good morning.
Mike Mendenhall of the Jacksonville Daily Record. Hi, Mike.
Good morning, Melissa.
And rounding out our foursome, WJCT reporter Raymond Troncoso. Hey, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Great to be here.
It's good to have all four of you here this week. Lots to talk about, and we'll go to your calls in a moment. 549-2937 to join us. Already getting your calls. Let's begin with our top story. This week, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis announced the appointment of Dr. Joseph A. Ladapo as Florida Surgeon General and Secretary of the Florida Department of Health. Ladapo hasn't even been confirmed yet by the Florida Senate, but he's already causing controversy. He's known for downplaying the effectiveness of masks and vaccines to fight COVID. And this week, he said the state will no longer require students who test positive for COVID to quarantine away from school. Here's the governor talking about quarantines.
Parent has a right to have a healthy kid in school. What are you going to say? You pass someone in the hall, and so you got to sit there for 10 days or 14 days? That has a huge cost on kids' upbringing.
We're beginning the hour with a closer look at this. Give us a call at 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Our Facebook page is open, too. Charles Griggs, I'd like to begin with you. You used to work at the Duval County Health Department. In fact, you were there for many years. Dr. Ladapo will be heading the Florida Department of Health, heading the state's COVID response. What's your reaction to this new rule he's put out on quarantine rules for kids?
Well, Melissa, let's talk first about the appointment itself. There was a time when public health and the science that's based on was hands off. Politicians didn't tread in that area for political gain or stake positions on ideology. In fact, in Florida, I think the shift occurred under Governor Jeb Bush when our own Dr. Goldhagen was forced out of our local health department because of his views on the state's approach to insurance reform and how that would impact children. What followed was a steady stream of DOH leaders who were beholden to the politics of three more governors along the way. However, even under those conditions, directors and state surgeon generals have tended to follow a broader the broader directives of accepted public health practices as outlined by trusted organizations like the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the National Health Institutes, Institutes of Health, and research arms of colleges and universities around the country. Now because of the intense nature of our ideological differences, we are seeing more and more political leaders take up space where pure science used to reside. And I'm clearly not surprised by the appointment of Dr. Ladapo. But based on Governor DeSantis' platform in response to principles related to COVID efforts, he checks all of the boxes. However, I am concerned about the state of Florida rank-and-file public health workers who are left to implement these shifts in public health ideology and policies. Their training hasn't led them to go down this path. So that's where my concern is that the people who are on the ground are going to have to carry out and implement these foreign practices, led by someone who is now shifting based upon politics.
Claire Goforth, Dr. Ladapo and the governor, as we heard, say that parents need to have more authority to decide whether their children go to school. after being exposed to people with COVID-19. Now, this is an emergency rule that also mentions opt-outs for a mask mandate. Of course, as we've been reporting all along, districts around the state have been defying the governor on mask mandates for kids for a while now. But what about this? The governor citing the state's Parent Bill of Rights, saying that if a child is asymptomatic, that they should be able to continue to go to school and not quarantine if they've been exposed to another child who has tested positive.
Well, I mean, what about the parents' rights not to have their children exposed to COVID-19? And we know that it can take several days for you to be symptomatic after exposure. So basically, this is just flying in the face of accepted science on how long it takes to develop symptoms. And so parents who are concerned that their children may get COVID, you know, they have no right at this point to say that, you know, you can't have a child at school who may be COVID positive sitting next to my child, which is kind of interesting because I think we all can recall in school that you would get sent home if you were sick with the flu, right? Or sick with a cold, you would get sent home. And so, you know, the flu or cold, they can both be deadly, but in very, very rare cases. But COVID-19 is a far more deadly virus. So, I mean, this is just another thing the governor is doing to attract headlines and that just flies right in the face of science. It's par for the course.
Let us know, parents, your thoughts. We're getting your calls. It's 549-2937. Raymond Troncoso, you know, I tweeted this out last night. We still have a child in the Duval County Public Schools at Douglas Anderson. Got a robocall last night from the school, and I've been getting these at least once a week since school started, letting me know that there's been another positive case of COVID at Douglas Anderson and that they would be in touch with me to let me know if my child was exposed, that the Department of Health would do contact tracing, and that if my child needs to quarantine, they'll let me know. That whole procedure, I honestly have the honest question, is that going to stop? Will some schools continue to honor that procedure? We're going to have to follow this, but you know, parents have so many questions right now, including me, is what I'm getting at.
So the big change to the health department rule is that students who are exposed to someone with a positive test do not have to quarantine. That's going to be at the discretion of parents.
The discretion of parents.
If you test positive for COVID, you will still be required to quarantine under the new health guidelines. But the big change is that if your student was directly exposed to COVID, normally there'd be a minimum of 4 days that you had to stay away from school and you would have to show a negative COVID test. Now, we know that it takes a while for COVID to actually start showing symptoms in someone from the time they're exposed. There really is no timeline for that under the new rule. So as long as you are asymptomatic, you don't show any immediate symptoms, you can be exposed to someone who has COVID and then show up to school the next day, potentially passing COVID on to others. Mm-hmm. Dr. Ladapo, he somewhat has a somewhat dubious history. You know, he, as a researcher at UCLA, he wasn't really involved with coronavirus research or treatment of patients. However, he did sign the Great Barrington Declaration, which kind of praised herd immunity and said that we should be letting people get infected as long as they're not part of vulnerable populations. Last year, he was also part of a group that kind of promoted hydroxychloroquine when that was a big thing.
Which is a discredited treatment. Yeah.
So it seems that DeSantis has gotten rid of the head of the health department, who was someone who was not really in the public eye, but maybe disagreed with some of his views, for someone who is pretty much lock in step with everything he's been saying throughout the duration of the pandemic.
Yeah. Mike Mendenhall, Dr. Ladapo is well credentialed. That said, he has espoused views which mainstream medicine finds fringe, even dangerous.
Yeah, you know, and you kind of continuing on what Raymond was saying, that, you know, since the beginning of the pandemic, the CDC scientists and pathologists have all, you know, stated that just because you are asymptomatic, you know, doesn't mean you can't transmit the virus. So, you know, part of the problem with this new rule is, you know, you could have students that are, you know, that are walking around in the general population of the school wouldn't even know that they had COVID, and they could spread it to somebody else who might develop symptoms or could get seriously ill. And you know, we're still waiting for the go ahead from the federal government to, you know, to immunize, you know, folks younger than 12 years old. So I mean, so this is an issue, and you know, it'll be interesting to see too if the Duval County school district or any other of the state's larger school districts kind of push back against this new rule as well. We've shown that they've been asked to do it before, you know, instituting mask mandates,
yeah,
when against the governor's will. And there will likely be, even though the legal challenge for the original rule is kind of now moot, there will likely be legal challenges once all of the official details and guidance come out of this as well.
Sure. As I was saying a minute ago, I can't say enough good things about Douglas Anderson. They have done a fabulous job of being responsive and proactive in communicating to parents whether there are COVID cases in the school and whether, as parents, we need to take any action with our own children. And my curiosity about this is, you know, will that continue in the same vein? Will that change under this new directive? Will there be another battle between the state and districts around Florida? Meanwhile, lots of calls from parents out there, 549-2937. We've got Jane on the line in Mandarin, a parent at River City Science Academy. Hi, Jane. Good morning.
Hi, just really quick, I wanted to say I'm frustrated that our school is not masking and we just had to go through a quarantine. We were told over the weekend of Labor Day that we were exposed on Friday. My son is wearing a mask. They told us that they needed to come in that following Tuesday and so that they could contact trace, but immediately told us to come home. We were able to come back on the Thursday, but then we're told that because we sent our students in on Tuesday, they were exposed a second time. So it was very frustrating, but I'm thankful that we have the quarantine so that we can keep our kids safe. I just wish they would use it better and also communicate better because it was the teacher that had COVID. And so the deans had to communicate with us while we were out and they didn't do a very good job of that. So I am for quarantining and I am for better communication during quarantine so that we can get a good education while we're out.
And Jane, you know, Jane, we've heard from other parents at schools like River City Science Academy, charter schools that don't have to follow the mask mandate enacted by the Duval County Public Schools. Parents at River City have complained about that to administrators. Can you talk about that?
I have sent emails directly to the school. I've also sent emails to the charter school in general that's in charge of all of them. I've only gotten one response, even though I've replied again. And it's just that they're following the executive order. And I responded with, at one point, the executive order was blocked. I need another excuse. I need to know what the threshold is. When will you mandate the masks? And I haven't got answers. And it's very frustrating. My son will continue to be masked until I feel like it's safe for him to be unmasked. Hopefully the vaccine will come out soon. That's all I can say. I just wish they would give us better excuses because I'm getting tired of it.
Thanks, Jane. Charles Griggs, you know, as Mike Mendenhall pointed out a minute ago, the Duval County Public Schools has been defying the state on masks for a while now, one of 13 districts. But not every school in this county falls under that, as we are learning. And there are certainly a lot of parents that are very concerned, and that vaccine for them cannot come soon enough.
Yeah, and the bottom line is that when we're talking about a public health crisis, a pandemic, the book says in a situation like this, quarantines should be the way to go. And the fact that we're not practicing those public health principles across the board, we're not even clear on them, what they should be, is causing chaos and confusion. I feel for parents across the state and across the country who have to deal with this in a way that is erratic, puts our children in harm's way. All of us know someone who's been impacted by COVID-19, mm-hmm. and we have questions regarding this that we, you know, simply cannot get answers in a consistent way that builds continuity for our response. So we're going to be challenged here in the next few months. And we've seen some some gains in terms of the slowing pace of infection, which is good news. But at the same time, we still run the risk of, you know, of seeing major infection again and not getting ourselves out of this position of being in the pandemic for years and months to come.
Yeah.
So
that's, you know, the criticism of this new directive on loosening quarantine for kids. Just as we are getting right at the edge of cases starting to go down, could this flare us all up again? I'm sure that is a worry of many. Eric in Arlington. Hi, Eric. Go ahead. Hi, Eric. You're on the air.
Good morning. Yeah, this narrative that's developed over the past couple of decades, I guess, has been gaining steam. That parents are somehow wizards, and as wizards, they know everything, and they know what's best for their children, and they know what's best for public health. This narrative someone has to do something to sort of nix this thing. If you go back and look at the history of the anti-vaxxer movement, it basically began when the media, in order to get ratings, would pit mothers against doctors when it came to vaccinations. That's where the anti-vaxxer movement came from. And I just think that it's unnecessary to continue with this myth, and that the best thing we could do is just tell parents, hey, look, you know, the public health is more important than, you know, this mythology, maintaining this mythology that somehow you're a wizard. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you for that. And Eric, you know, of course, there was a big movement among parents to look at whether mercury in vaccines, thimerosal was the name of the compound, was contributing to autism rates in children. That was a big concern for a lot of parents with kids on the autism spectrum. Subsequent studies have found that there isn't a direct link. They have removed thimerosal from most vaccines, although I do think it is still in some flu shots. But getting to that, you know, Claire Goforth, what about this? Yesterday, Senator Manny Diaz, the top Republican shaping health care policy in the upper chamber of Tallahassee, says that he wants to actually revisit mandates for all childhood vaccines, including polio, mumps and rubella, measles, mumps and rubella and polio. So the top Republican in Florida who is in charge of healthcare policy is now saying, why do we need rules for vaccine shots for kids to enter school and get vaccinated against polio, measles, mumps and rubella, you know, whooping cough, diphtheria? This is extraordinary.
It really is. You know, we have been mandating these vaccines for decades and to great effect. Polio has been eradicated. And what we've seen in recent years is some of the anti-vaxxer movement has resulted in flare-ups of measles in certain communities where vaccines are deeply unpopular. By putting parents, as your previous caller said, in the position of being these wizards who have, you know, the end-all be-all say in what their children are forced to take medically or learn, I mean, it's putting us all in a position where we could see the comeback of polio and measles and mumps and rubella and many other very dangerous diseases that can maim and kill many people in our population. And, you know, while many in the anti-vaxxer movement would make the argument, well, it's my choice whether or not I'm vaccinated, the only person who's harmed is me. Well, the reality is that some people are actually immunosuppressed, and so they, even with vaccines, can be susceptible to serious disease. The idea of vaccines is to protect all of us as a population and to achieve herd immunity through vaccines without having to have, you know, massive amounts of disease run through our society. And that's the same principle that's behind quarantines. We've been quarantining for centuries. You know, Shakespeare wrote some of his finest works while in quarantine to avoid the plague. It's been so long accepted that at some point, I guess people have become complacent and they no longer recognize that quarantine is a very time-tested and effective strategy to minimize the spread of disease. I'm not sure if Diaz is 100% sincere in hoping that this legislation passes, or again, you know, they have made a cottage industry, essentially, of trying to grab headlines with extreme legislation, and this may be an example of that.
Les on the West Side. Hi, Les. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to ask if anybody could clarify why not getting a vaccine, when you, especially when you have children, is not considered child neglect. Thank you.
Well, thank you for that. You know, certainly there are allowances for parents who object to vaccination for their children. The religious exemption to vaccination is the most commonly used loophole in Florida and other states. Okay, but getting back to the discussion of quarantining students, Raymond, what about this? Here's an email from Stinson. The governor's press release states that all of the students quarantined last year, only 2% eventually tested positive. The other 98% returned to school with a negative test. So do they think it's reasonable to conclude that quarantining students due to exposure but without a positive test is overreacting? That's the argument the governor is making through this new appointment, that quarantining students who've been exposed but have no symptoms is an overreaction. Your thoughts?
Yeah, well, they're saying that, you know, 2% of those students in quarantine eventually did become symptomatic, had COVID. And we know how most diseases work, especially one as infectious as COVID, is you don't just pass it on to one other person. It's kind of a exponential spread. So, you know, it is important that 2% does stay away from the rest of the population, because in a system where you don't have any sort of quarantining when someone gets sick, or people can just start coming the next day after they're exposed to someone, they can expose 2, 3, 4 more people, who in turn can expose 2, 3, 4 more people. And that kind of is how it balloons out of control, especially when we have this very infectious Delta variant that's the main strain right now of the virus.
Jeff in Springfield. Hi, Jeff. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
Great.
Hey, real quick, I think we're conflating two things. We have a right as a parent, and I'm pro-vaccination, by the way. We have a right as a parent to choose what goes into our kids' bodies and in your own body, but you don't necessarily then have a right to access to public schools, and that's what people are conflating. If public schools are for the public, if you'd like to not do that, then you shouldn't have access to that resource from the community. Now, we have conflated and said that every child has a right to an education. That's fine. But we need to make sure that we don't tie the two together, that you have a right to violate this, to endanger other people, and do that. If you focus on whether or not we're revisiting our parents' rights to have access, to put vaccinations in our kids, that's going to get into really dangerous territory, and I don't agree with that. But I am completely okay with saying, okay, you didn't follow that rule, but then you don't have access to public schools. And that's part of the problem.
Thanks.
That is the source of some of the problem, I think.
Yeah, thank you for that, Jeff. Here's a tweet from Susan. This is why getting more people their shots is crucial for controlling the spread of the virus. Every vaccinated person helps limit the virus's ability to hide, replicate, and propagate. It's our Friday Media Roundtable, talking about the biggest stories of the week with Raymond Troncoso, Charles Griggs, Mike Mendenhall, Claire Goforth, and yours truly, 549-2937. Okay, we need to move on and talk about another big story from the week that we broke here at WJCT News. Jacksonville's main library downtown, we have learned this week, will be closed indefinitely for upgrades, as it's being described, because the library is the site of the city's state-run COVID antibody treatment clinic. City spokeswoman Nikki Kimbleton says there's only a verbal agreement with the state to use the library and conference center for free. We don't know how much longer this is going to be going on, but the library is closed to the public because it is the site for people to come and get Regeneron monoclonal antibody treatment if they are positive for COVID. This is effective if you are positive and getting sick. If you get it early enough, it can keep you out of the hospital. Since the city opened this state-run clinic below the main library, nearly 8,000 people have received the treatment. Mike Mendenhall, though, Jack's Daily Record, because the library is closed, people can't go to the library. For example, a resource for people with disabilities called Talking Books, they have to go all the way to the Daytona Beach Library now to get that service. So on the one hand, yes, the monoclonal antibody treatments are helping people. But on the other hand, people are asking, why is the library the site for this clinic? Why not the Regency Mall, say, Mike, where there was a vaccination and testing site for months? Do we know the answer to that?
No, I don't think we do. I think the city has, has just said that, they had a very short timetable to select a site, and that was the site they selected. And, and that one of the issues is that, or one of the other issues is that, that just like public school, just like public education, public libraries are an equalizer. They're a resource for people, for people to get to access information, to access computers, to access, books and knowledge that they may not otherwise have. And the downtown library in particular, I think it was pointed out in your story at WJCT, is that, that this library is the closest in proximity to many of our shelters for people experiencing homelessness. So, they rely on this facility to do a lot of things and as a resource to help better their situation. So that's one of the issues there that's really problematic.
Here's an email from Robert. It is beyond ridiculous the public can't get an answer from the city about why our main library was chosen as the only Regeneron treatment space. It has been unnecessarily disruptive to popular public services when equally large, lesser-used buildings like the Prime Osborne Center or the Legends Center sit barely used. Can anyone get an answer from any elected official? Charles Griggs, this may have been a decision that the state forced on the city. We don't know. What we do know is that library employees were just told out of the blue to get out of the building and stay out with very little notice. They are all now working remotely. Some of them have quit. We don't have answers.
Yeah, and again, the people I've spoken with are asking the question, how can a major public resource like the main library be shut down indefinitely when it's such an important part of our community? Imagine if this were the main library in other communities like Philly, Atlanta, or Charlotte. This wouldn't happen. It would be easier probably for the administration and for the state who's actually administering these medical services to explain why this is such an important site. And it also would probably be better for the public if they made plans to transition sometime soon. And we know that that even though they've served, I think more than, like you said, more than 8,000 people, the cases, the opportunity to serve people now are slacking off some. Mm-hmm. So there could be an opportunity to transition this to a more useful location and allow the public library to be reopened and the public to have access to it again.
Here's another email from Barbara. Why didn't they use the Regency Mall site or the Prime Osborne? Now that the library is closed, we've taken away a critical free service from the city's urban core, a detrimental decision. Meanwhile, Claire Goforth, we've had widespread access here in Florida to monoclonal antibody treatments. However, a representative at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has told the Washington Post the federal government plans to limit the quantity of the treatment each state can receive because just 7 states, including Florida, have used up 70% of the nation's supply of the treatment. That's honestly a failure of this state, Claire, to be more proactive about getting the word out about vaccinations, distancing, and masking, because people are testing positive and they're virtually all unvaccinated and coming in as a Hail Mary to get Regeneron.
Yes, I mean, Regeneron is a wonderful drug for people who contract COVID, but better than Regeneron is not contracting COVID in the first place. And we know that in order to do that, you can take a vaccine and you're much less likely to contract it. And if you do, you're very, very unlikely to have a severe enough case to require hospitalization. And, for months now, in spite of an early push for vaccines and the DeSantis administration continuing to say that they do support vaccines, they've really put the emphasis on personal choice when it comes to vaccines and when it comes to masks and when it comes to social distancing. And the result of that is just what we're seeing, where Florida is one of the states that's using a disproportionate amount of the Regeneron supply, which puts people in other states, including children who cannot access the vaccine vaccine as of yet, at more risk of not being able to get this life-saving treatment. While it's a wonderful drug, as I said, you know what? It's better to be vaccinated and to not catch COVID or get seriously ill from it in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about the local numbers, Raymond. In Duval County, here is the statistic. About 60% of people over the age of 11 have received at least one dose of the vaccine. That compares to 75% nationwide. So we are undervaxxed in our area.
Yeah, we are undervaxxed, and we do use up most of the monoclonal antibody treatments that we have in the state are going to Northeast Florida, the First Coast, which of course was not just at the epicenter of a Florida outbreak, but of a national outbreak not that long ago. And we know with the Biden administration starting to limit the supply of Regeneron, DeSantis announced recently that he's buying monoclonal antibody treatments from other pharmaceutical companies besides Regeneron. So we're getting from GlaxoSmithKline 3,000 doses of Sotrovimab, which instead of the injection that Regeneron is an IV drip. These also have some authorization from the FDA, but they're not as tested as Regeneron, which is why the federal government has kind of used that as a gold standard. So it seems that DeSantis is kind of going all in on treatment rather than actually prevention, which seems to be the better course that the rest of the country is kind of going for.
And that gets back to what you were saying earlier, Charles Griggs, about the appointment of the state's new Surgeon General. Politicians are inserting their politics into what used to be nonpartisan public health decisions.
Yeah, and it's really troubling, because what we should be seeing now is a coordinated effort between federal resources, state resources, and local resources in order to mitigate the impact of this pandemic. But instead, what we're seeing is differences in ideology play out along political lines. And that's across the board. You know, what the Biden administration is doing is trying to, keep a leg up on how they implement their programs in response. And you see the governor's administration sort of responding to that with its own ideology related to how the pandemic should be treated, in keeping with his voice and saying that people should have choices during this pandemic. This is a public health crisis. It doesn't have anything to do with individual rights. It is a public health crisis. That means we have to respond to this in a way that protects the public at large, which means that your individual rights are going to be superseded by things that in a public health crisis that the experts are telling you to do based upon science. And it's unfortunate that we're here when people are trying to stake out political ground based on who their bases are, and not providing us the highest quality of response to this public health crisis. And hopefully in the days to come, in the months to come, people will get together and we'll see better responses to this pandemic.
If you're just tuning in, it's our Friday roundtable, 549-2937. Now, we've been talking since the top of the hour about the pandemic, but another big story this week that I think is going to generate some calls. What on earth is going on with trash pickup in this city? Has this affected your neighborhood? Well, this week, the mayor said the city of Jacksonville may temporarily suspend picking up recycling in order so that they can devote resources limited by staff shortages to picking up yard waste. Now, the city has $4 million in federal COVID relief funding to help out with the backlog of trash that's been piling up in dozens of neighborhoods over weeks. The mayor says that they want to prioritize yard waste over recycling, and they're going to present that to a city council committee. Apparently, this is a nationwide issue. Municipalities dealing with labor shortages in garbage and trash pickup. There's a driver shortage. There's a deeper issue about that. Why is there a shortage of drivers? Why are people refusing to do these jobs? But in the meantime, homeowners are fed up. We have been hearing from you for weeks now. Thousands of complaints all over town. Are you one of them? Let us know the situation on your block as we talk about trash. 549-2937, Mike Mendenhall, Jack's Daily Record. Basically, the trash isn't getting picked up, and it could be that our recycling might not get picked up for a while, too.
Yeah, it appears that way, you know, and, you know, at City Hall, on City Council, you know, you can talk about sports performance centers for Jaguars, big multi-million dollar deals and, you know, long-term planning all you want to. But, you know, when it comes to issues like trash pickup, potholes and trash pickup, it's a nuts and bolts issue. And the City Council has been hearing it. You know, there's rarely a committee meeting that goes by right now where a City Council member doesn't mention how many emails they've received on the inability for trash pickup to happen. You know, a lot of these trash pickup companies, you know, like a lot of other, you know, logistics and transportation jobs around the country, they're doing everything they can, from sign-on bonuses to increasing pay, you know, trying to be more flexible with benefits and schedules, to really try to entice more people to take care of this labor shortage, but it's just not happening. And so, you know, and it'll be interesting to see how the companies that the city contracts with are going to use this $4 million, you know, to actually take care of the problem.
Yeah. 549-2937. Folks, are you having trouble getting trash picked up where you live? Give us a call. Jessica in San Marco. Hi, Jessica.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you so much for talking about this, something I've been concerned about for a while. I am not a homeowner. I live in a high-rise in San Marco, right on the water, luxury high-rise, and yet our recycling has been suspended for about 3 months now. I've intentionally picked that building because it sorted recycling into far more categories than what the city required. And so the fact that it's not being picked up at all gives me grave concern and a lot of moral grief. But I also wanted to point out the favoring these homeowners with, you know, quote unquote yard waste and allocating money there. What about all these new apartments that they're putting in around the city? A lot of us are not homeowners, some of us intentionally so. So how does this benefit us, and how does this actually reduce the stuff that you can't burn, unlike what I would imagine are trees, parts of dead trees that fall off in the yard? All right. I'll take my answer off air.
Jessica, thank you for that. Claire, go forth.
Sure, I feel her frustration there, but yard waste isn't just a cosmetic issue, and it isn't just something that people who choose to own a home or have the financial means to own a home should be concerned with. We should all be concerned with it because it is a public health hazard. It's a breeding ground for insects such as the unofficial state bird, the mosquito, and it also is a great risk to our waterways, that very river that the caller looks out upon. If yard waste is not picked up, which includes a lot of pesticide-ridden and fertilizer-ridden grass clippings and shrubbery, makes it into the tributaries that are, you know, the ditches that are run along a lot of the neighborhoods, then it makes its way into the river, and so do those pollutants. So, I mean, yard waste, it is certainly, it's an eyesore, but more than that, it is a public health concern and a great concern to our waterways.
Isla Ray in Riverside. Isla Ray, how are you today? Having some trash issues?
Fine.
Go ahead.
Thank you. I have a problem with semantics. At the top of your discussion of this particular topic, you use the word refusing to work in this area. And that plays into a narrative of lazy people collecting $300 checks or whatever. I think the question is, why are there not workers available? It could be there are many reasons that they're not filling those slots, and refusing to work is a dangerous way to describe. Yeah.
No, I agree with you. And that's why I said that it brings up a deeper issue as to why there is a labor shortage in the first place. And I actually completely take your point. I wasn't trying to indicate that people were being lazy, but that let's talk about that, Raymond. This is a national problem. Here's an email from a listener. This is not just a problem in Duval County. We are having a trash problem in Clay County, too.
Yeah, so I spoke with Ron Whittington of Career Source yesterday, not about this issue specifically with trash and waste pickup, but we did talk about the job numbers. So unemployment in Northeast Florida is actually lower than it was January of 2020 before the pandemic. And total employment numbers are also higher. So it's not that people, you know, there aren't people who are willing to work. It seems that we're pretty much gainfully employed. It's a labor shortage in that these are jobs that either don't pay enough or don't offer enough benefits to entice people to take them. And I'm glad that, you know, it's finally been admitted that it's a national issue. It's a labor shortage, when before some of the rationale was as the previous caller just mentioned, oh, it's because unemployment benefits are so good. People would rather take unemployment benefits than working. Now that Florida for a long time didn't honor the national unemployment benefits that were going out from the Biden administration, people still aren't seeing their trash getting picked up. And now we're finally getting rid of the scapegoat. And we can see the real issue is we're in a labor shortage, which means it's an employees market. So trash pickup companies, city governments, municipal governments, county governments, they need to kind of step up in terms of their recruitment and offer better
and
pay
offer better
and better
pay.
Benefits.
Exactly. Here's a tweet from Jimmy. Why can't people take their trash to the Trail Ridge landfill on the west side? That should be a free option right now, he says. So Charles Griggs, people are reaching that point where they just want to go to the landfill themselves.
Yeah, that would be. I've heard people talk about how that would be an option to maybe have a location where folks could take their own trash out of frustration, out of necessity, or just because it's a better option for them or it's more convenient. But again, you know, this problem doesn't seem like it's very complicated, but it is. You know, the trash collective vendors are arguing that good help is hard to find. But the marketplace says the value of the job description has increased. So, so the vendors need to find other ways to offer incentives and fill those positions so they can get the job done. Now, that's probably going to take, they're probably going to lose some money in the process. And I understand this is what the $4 million is supposed to perhaps subsidize. But at the same time, you know, this new marketplace, especially in this industry, is telling them that they got to do more in order to attract new workers. Perhaps it means changing the way they do business or providing more, I don't know, you're just making sure the job is more, I don't know, glorious or whatever, but people think about trash collection. They don't see golden parachutes, right?
It's not a glorious job by any means, but as Ray pointed out, it could be a slightly better paying job, and then maybe that it would be easier to staff these positions. Don on the South Side, go ahead.
A few months ago, somebody that I know was laid off from the waste management when they were acquired by a new company. So they downsized their employees, and I assume now they don't have enough employees to do the work.
Right. I think that's a fair assumption, Don. Thank you for that. Mike Mendenhall, you cover City Hall pretty closely. And any inklings as to when they might be able to resolve this crisis?
Well, I think you're going to see, if I'm not mistaken, that $4 million will come up before City Council on Tuesday night. So as far as the money is concerned, I mean, that'll happen probably Tuesday. But right now, too, you know, there's contract issues with some of the city's waste. Waste contractors. One didn't get renewed, and they're trying to fill that. Those customers are going to be absorbed by another one of the city's waste contractors, I think there's even after the emergency funding is passed, they're still going to have to continue to work on solutions because. I mean, it probably won't be a permanent fix. And the $4 million is coming from COVID aid, federal COVID aid from the Biden administration. So, I mean, it's a one-time deal. I mean, so it's not going to be a line item that'll continually come out of the city budget annually unless for some reason the city council seems to think that they want to continue to have to subsidize that industry. But I think that's unlikely.
Thanks for that. Okay, another note for everyone. Congress has fewer than 10 days to pass legislation to prevent another partial government shutdown. This is happening again, folks. You think the trash pickup is a pain. If the government shuts down again, we're going to see more annoyances and disruptions to our lives. The familiar political standoff over spending and debt could have serious economic consequences, too. Hopefully this can get resolved. Very soon, we will continue to follow it here at WJCT News. Okay, a few minutes left, and I'm going to kick off our lightning round, stories you might have missed from the week, by letting you all know that Sam has becoming a hurricane, Tropical Storm Sam, and is expected to strengthen over the weekend. The Florida Public Radio Emergency Network says Sam will hopefully stay out to sea, but it's still too soon to predict whether it will hit Florida or the U.S. coast. Let's hope it does stay far away. Okay, Ray, what's on your radar this week?
Well, in Congress, we had the recent vote on the defense missile system for Israel. Just had the vote passed overwhelmingly in the House, though with some opposition from the progressive wing, including AOC, famously.
Thanks for that, Raymond. Charles Griggs.
Well, it was tough for me, but I guess I had to go with the Jaguars versus the Cardinals. The Cardinals are averaging 450 yards per game. About two-thirds of that are passing yards, which doesn't bode well for the Jaguars because their defense is giving up an average of 425 yards a game. So it might be an ugly Sunday.
It might be. Claire Goforth.
Thanks for that, Charles. On my radar is that a Florida Republican has proposed our version of the Texas heartbeat bill that would essentially outlaw abortion rights and abortion in Florida.
We will discuss that at length today at noon, by the way, on the Florida Roundup. So please listen at noon. And let's close it out with Mike Mendenhall.
Yeah, so Charles is watching the Jaguars on the field. I'm kind of watching what the Jaguars are doing off the field. The Shad Khan's proposed four seasons legislation is working its way through city council. We're going to start to see some real debate on that here in the next 2 weeks. And I'm curious to see kind of how the city council is going to position with $114 million incentive package on the table.
Thanks, Mike. And thanks to all of you for being with us. Have a great weekend. Claire, Ray, Charles, Mike. Enjoy your fall weather. Thanks so much.
Same to you, Melissa.
Thanks, Melissa. Same. Have a great
weekend. Thanks, Melissa.
All right, a quick break in a moment. Bill Delaney's out with a new book, Secret Jacksonville, A Guide to the Weird, Wonderful, and Obscure. We'll go inside the pages of that next.
Once you shut down a nuclear power plant, what do you do with the hot stuff inside? On the next Science Friday, a look at the unsolved problem of storing long-lived nuclear waste.
I mean, you got plutonium-237, 239. This stuff has a half-life of 24,000 years. We're talking essentially forever.
Plus a kid's eye view of Dr. Anthony Fauci, all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
In Washington, some Democrats are making life hard for their party and the president.
I suspect this deal will be declared dead several times, but this is the core of President Biden's agenda. It will get done.
Border Patrol comes under fire for its tactics near the Rio Grande and a presidential promise to get the crisis under control. The Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, it's a new book giving you insight into some of the city's most interesting offbeat and secret places. Writer Bill Delaney of our partners at The Jackson is out with his new book, Secret Jacksonville, A Guide to the Weird, Wonderful, and Obscure. He's on the line. Hey, Bill.
Hi, Melissa.
Hey, congrats on the book. This is such fun. So you're, of course, the co-owner of The Jackson Mag, and you've grown up here. What inspired this new book?
Well, you know, I've always just had a love of the city and especially a love of finding unusual and, you know, strange and little known things. So it felt like a perfect fit. My publisher, Reedy Press, was looking for a local author to do a book like this, and I jumped at the chance.
You know, this is so timely and so appropriate because this part of Florida is sort of Florida's best kept secret anyway. You know,
yeah,
we're sort of
right.
The secret city of Florida. So you kind of tap into that, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, like I call it the secret city because, you know, there's so much that even people, who live here their entire lives that they just don't know. And even more than that, we're kind of a city of sides where in many cases people just kind of stick to their own area and don't venture out as much as they could. And so something that's well known in one place might just be a total arcane mystery to folks in you know, right down the street.
That's right. There is so much to explore because it is such a big spread out place. So what are some secrets that we will discover in reading your book?
Well, one that I knew I wasn't going to be able to get away with not having is Sexy Rexy, the Beach Boulevard dinosaur.
At Beach and Peach, yeah.
Yeah. It's a big orange concrete dinosaur that was originally a mini golf obstacle that was retained as kind of the mascot of a strip mall on Beach Boulevard. But he's well known and beloved in Jacksonville because he's kind of a beacon. Like, people will give directions like, turn left at the dinosaur.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. I was so glad they didn't tear it down when they changed that development over there. So that's just one example. But you found some other really interesting stuff that I hadn't heard about, like a long-forgotten Florida waterfall. What's that?
Yeah, that's one of my favorites. That's out in Bulls Bay Preserve on the west side. It's only 10 minutes from downtown. In fact, you can see downtown from right outside the preserve. You can see the skyline. But it is a preserve that has history dating back to Isaiah D. Hart, the founder of Jacksonville. It was the site of his slave plantation. And after the Civil War, it was used for like logging and, you know, sand mining and stuff. It was never really developed. And so in the 90s, the city bought it to preserve it. But they never, you know, it took them 20 years to really make a park out of it. And so in 2019, they finally opened trails. And lo and behold, in the middle of this preserve, there's a waterfall, 4-foot-tall waterfall. And that's something I had no idea until I stumbled upon it. You know, and I've lived here my entire life. Mm-hmm. It's one of the most accessible waterfalls in Florida. Not that it has a lot of competition for that.
I was going to say, I didn't think there were any. That's the thing about living here. There's all kinds of weird, funky, and interesting little quirks about living here. I think that's the word I'm getting to, Bill. This is a quirky mm-hmm. place.
Yeah, it definitely is. And I don't think we give ourselves enough credit for being quirky and for the things that really make us stand out. I mean, we have our own kind of pepper in this region, the daddle pepper.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty much only grown in, St. Augustine and the Jacksonville area.
You also write
camel
about
rider sandwiches,
garlic crabs, Mayport shrimp. You get into all of the foods that are unique to this area.
Absolutely. Yeah, that comes, I'm also a editor and co-owner of Edible Northeast Florida magazine. And so I've been able to dive into a lot of, our food scene and what really makes that special. And I mean, garlic crabs especially is one that up in the north side, there's dozens of garlic crab places. You know, for people in the know, we're really well known for garlic crabs, but a lot of people in the city, I have no idea. There's a lot of people that never tried them or don't even know what they are.
Right. So picking up your book, which, by the way, is out now, available wherever books are sold, and would make a great gift this holiday for the local Jack's person in your life. People can buy the book, but they can also come out to some signings you have coming up and some walking tours. So fill us in. Where can people come out and see you?
Yes, so next Tuesday, I'm doing a reading and signing with two other local authors, Tim Gilmore and Darlin Fitch-Kuhn, at UNF at 6:30. I'm also hosting walking tours. The first one is October 9th. It's a Saturday at 9 a.m. And that's going to cover a number of the sites in downtown Jacksonville that are covered in the book.
So come on out and see Bill Delaney as he debuts his new book, Secret Jacksonville. And we didn't even get into the fact that this is the birthplace of Southern rock and has the largest population of Gullah Geechee descendants in the world. Two more things that you write about, right?
Yeah, right. You know, we have one of the largest Arab American populations in the country. And there's a lot that we really ought to take more credit for.
That's right. And some of the most important civil rights heroes of the land came from Jacksonville. like James Weldon Johnson and A. Philip Randolph, among others. So much in this book. I'm going through even more talking points where the birthplace of modern shrimping. Bill has just really produced an amazing book about this city. So get your copy of Secret Jacksonville and go meet Bill. He'll be having several talks over the next month. Congrats, Bill Delaney of the Jackson Modern Cities and Edible. We always enjoy having you on and look forward to hearing from you again soon.
All right. Thanks so much, Melissa.
And thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks to all of our guests and callers, too, along with senior producer Heather Schatz, director Josh Torres, and associate producer Catherine Hobbs. I'm Melissa Ross. Make sure to join us today at noon on the Florida Roundup, your live statewide call-in program, rounding up the biggest stories around the state. We'll talk about that new abortion bill and the appointment of the state's new Surgeon General and more. The Florida Roundup today at noon. See you then.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.